Well, the presentation title for this session is Will There Be Food? However, as we contemplate the serious consequences of the situation that Molly just described to us, I actually got a little depressed. But perhaps some other questions might also be, what kind of food are we talking about? How much food? And for whom? And we also might want to look at what kind of food production and distribution system will we need in order to develop and maintain healthy lifestyles for most people. So I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So I can go right on here and tell you about what we've been doing at the Agricultural Sustainability Institute in developing our food carbon footprint initiative. The goal being, let me just go back a minute and acknowledge my colleagues, Sonia Brote, senior researcher on this initiative, and Tom Tomich, who is the director of the Agricultural Sustainability Institute. So our goal in this initiative is to reduce energy intensity and greenhouse gases in the food system, and at the same time to promote actions towards a low-carbon diet. And the framework we're using to look at this is life cycle assessment, or sometimes abbreviated LCA. You might see that in the literature. And that basically, in a nutshell, is gathering data from farm to fork, all the way through the supply chain for particular commodities. And the way that we are planning to use this is putting together the research, but then we wanted to have a lot of outreach with policymakers, agricultural professionals, the food industry, who have been very interested in this, consumers, and now, of course, the public health and nutrition community, who want to promote individual and community health for all people, but also want to do it in an environmentally responsible way. So we've been hearing about climate change for the last few years and the part that humans play in it. And as we've heard from Molly, the food system is one of those important human activities because it has to do with our daily and long-term survival. And it is unquestionably a big contributor to global warming. Up to 30% of the food system is responsible, or is responsible for up to 30% of global warming. Yet it also represents an opportunity, I think, for all of us to think about ways that we can use the food system to decrease greenhouse gases and energy in the food, and energy to contribute less to climate change. And additionally, for you all in the public health community, it's a win-win because the strategies that we're going to be talking about also are the same strategies that we've been talking about for many years in trying to get people to think about health, food, and nutrition that promotes well-being for everyone. So Molly did describe where these greenhouse gases occur in the food system, and I just want to review it briefly. I'll probably go through this fairly quickly, but there's two ways of thinking about them. One is by looking throughout the supply chain, and the other is by looking at the contributions by food group. So let me just run through this fairly quickly. Molly described how agricultural production is one of the important ways that greenhouse gases arise. In fact, 50% of food-related greenhouse gases occur in agricultural production, mostly through methane and in livestock production, nitrous oxide through soils, manure, fertilizer application, and then fossil fuel-generated carbon dioxide in machinery, pesticides, and fertilizer production. And then, of course, agriculture also contributes to climate change by changing land use patterns and removing forestry and having that land go into agriculture or into grazing land for animals. Transportation is another area in which greenhouse gases are emitted. And I think it's important to also note the type of transportation we're talking about. There's ship, rail, air, and truck, which have different ramifications for how much greenhouse gases are emitted, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. But I think even though we want to talk about beyond food miles, we really need to keep that in mind, because currently we do have a very globalized food system and a commitment to long-distance shipping, and if we really want to deal with climate change, we're going to have to make some different decisions about how food is transported from one place to the other. And so until we can do that, food miles really has to be a big concern. And then another way is processing our foods and how they're maintained and stored in retail outlets, mostly through refrigeration. Refrigeration is actually ubiquitous, from farm gate all the way to home use, and it's a place that we need to pay attention. And then consumption, and that includes going and getting the food at the grocery store, cooking, storing it, and unfortunately, waste. When food is wasted and it goes to the landfill, methane is released. That's one important greenhouse gas. But even more importantly, all of the stages before that the food went through to get to your table, all of those emissions are also wasted. So it's sort of a double whammy, or more than that. In the United Kingdom, one study showed that households waste up to 30% of their food purchases, and it's really not very much more, it's not any better in the United States. So there's a long way to go on that front. If we think about contributions of greenhouse gases by food group, which is another way to think about it, and Molly showed this slide too, up to 50% of foods are either meat and dairy are the main categories that contribute to greenhouse gases. This is one study from the Netherlands. And this is a study, Chris Jones at UC Berkeley has done these. I'm not sure what you call this kind of diagram. I kind of, a bubble diagram, actually. But it shows greenhouse gases per gram of food product on the left, the y-axis, or greenhouse gases per dollar on the x-axis. And either way you cut it, whether you're a nutritionist or whether you're an economist, you can see up in the upper right corner you have meat products and dairy products. So those are the high emitters of greenhouse gases and energy. So as we began to look at all these things at the Ag Sustainability Institute and unpack what was going on in the food system, we began to realize that there are some trade-offs between various sectors. It's more complex than it looks, and that if you try to lower energy use in one sector, you may be increasing it in another. And there are a lot of questions that come about because of that. For example, there has been this ongoing dilemma that many of you have heard among environmentally conscious consumers, where they're asking, should I eat organic or should I eat local? What's the best? There's always decisions to be made. And the answer, of course, is that it all depends. And from our perspective, it depends on what is going on throughout the supply chain. When we do a life cycle assessment, we're adding up all of the contributions at each stage of the life cycle of a food, like this diagram shows for tomato paste, which was one of the first products we began to look at. So we decided, since there was very little data out there, except for most of the data had been collected and the studies had been conducted in Europe, we pulled together European researchers that had been doing food and life cycle assessment research about a year ago, and they came from Switzerland, Denmark, the Netherlands, the UK, and we asked them to help us design a research framework to look at some of these trade-offs and critical issues. And we wanted that framework and the issues to span across the supply chain and not necessarily focus on one thin slice of it. And we also wanted to identify those hot spots or areas that really needed particular attention that were rising to the surface as we began to do the literature reviews and to pull together this research framework. So we came up with 5 key questions, and what I'd like to do now is just review those key questions. We don't have the answers to those yet, but they're helping us to design the kinds of studies that we want to do. So the first one is the trade-off between the type of production system and transport distance. So from a consumer's perspective, one might ask, is it better to buy organic vegetables that are imported from out of state or out of the country, or conventionally grown vegetables that are grown locally? Well, part of the answer to that depends on the system one uses to produce the food. We know that organic systems often have lower energy use and greenhouse gases, primarily because of the fertilizer that's used in conventional systems. But then one has to compare the yield in both of those systems to see what the numbers really come out to be. And then once you do that, you can look at the transport and find how far one can transport a particular food product before the savings that you gain from the production practices begins to evaporate. So that's one way of looking at that question. The second one has to do with the scale of food production. How do small-scale local food systems with small farms and short supply lines and direct marketing compare to regional-scale food systems or global food systems with global distribution system with global distribution plans? And part of the answer to that involves looking more carefully at the transportation. And this is what I was talking about. You can see the relative differences in energy use between ship, railroad, highway, and air, and how much higher it is to transport something by air travel. The third question has to do with the combination of seasonality, production, processing, and transport. So one might ask, in the wintertime, maybe not in California though, is it better to buy a local canned tomato, or is it better to buy fresh tomatoes that are shipped from out of the country or the other side of the country? What makes the most sense? And to look at this, we need to think more about the processing. And let me show you this one study to give you an idea of how important it is to look through the whole supply chain. This is a study that compares fluid and dry milk and energy use in that. And when you first look at it, you see that big green bar that's going way up, which is processing for dried milk. And you think, well, that's clearly the most energy-intense food product. But when you add up all the energy use at each stage of the life cycle, you can see that fluid milk is actually more energy, uses more energy. So this underscores the importance of looking at the whole picture before coming to conclusions. One other thing about this is sort of food production processing in a way I wanted to underline is the large energy use in heated greenhouses. I'm not talking about hoop houses or season extension practices that you may have heard of, but when you use heated greenhouses, it uses quite a bit more energy than producing them in open air. And this one study from Sweden showed that even transporting fresh or canned tomatoes from southern Europe was way more efficient than growing them locally in greenhouses. Then the fourth question, the big one that always brings a lot of emotion with it, it seems, is livestock production systems. And how do different protein products compare, eggs, chicken, fish, beef, etc., and how do they compare to plant-derived protein? And here we can see that at the present time, meat and dairy take up a lot of the carbon footprint in the food system, and in fact, animal-based foods are from 2 to 100 times more energy intensive than plant-based foods. One can also look at how meat is produced, and I think the data is still ambiguous out there as to whether range-fed or feedlot is better. I know for other reasons what I would vote for, but from strictly a carbon point of view, there are trade-offs that we still need to consider. And then the fifth question has to do with us as consumers post-retail. Once we get our food from the grocery store, and what energy is used in the storing and preparing and, unfortunately, wasting food. This study, again from Kramer, shows that consumption accounts for about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions in the Dutch food supply, and that's that salmon-colored quartile over there. And that's mostly having to do with kitchen appliances, mostly refrigeration, but also consumer transport and cooking method. And a similar result here from home storage for tomato ketchup. So from all of these studies, and as we began to pull things together, we came up with six what we're calling hot spots, or areas that really need attention that we think are important and perhaps sinks for CO2 and their greenhouse gas emitters at the moment that we've been reading about. And the top of the list is livestock-related methane and nitrous oxide emissions. That's really number one. Then there's synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. As you saw, air freight is a pretty high on the carbon footprint scale, as are heated greenhouses. Then there's post-retail, consumer transport, and food storage. If you decide to buy food locally, let's say at your farmer's market, but you drive down to the farmer's market in an SUV, pick up one thing and drive back, you're probably erasing all of the carbon emissions you've saved. So, I mean, it's important to look at that. And then food waste at multiple points in the supply chain. So here are the things that we saw as the issues and the problems. What I'd like to do in the next couple of minutes is just review what to do about it. And for this, I want to add in some information from this great report called Cooking Up a Storm. It was just published by the Food Climate Research Network. If anybody has been on that website, it's amazingly good. Tara Garnett published this, and this is the summary of it. But she suggests there's two basic kinds of ways of reducing food carbon footprints. One of them is the technological and managerial options, which include things like Molly has suggested already, anaerobic digestion, solar and wind power, using manure instead of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, mixed cropping systems for nitrogen recycling, organic agriculture, soil carbon sequestration, efficient refrigeration, shifting to sea and rail as opposed to truck and air transport for food, and then energy metering at the retail level, and food labeling, and anything we can do to reduce waste strategies. And then the other piece that she says, this is not enough, we really need to be changing our food behaviors. And that's where I think many of us in the public health community also come in, which is talking to people about our food procurement strategies, including meat consumption, eating less meat, eating less overall, seasonally and locally, the suggestion of preparing meals several at a time and avoiding waste as much as possible, storing and cooking in energy-saving ways, and basically consuming less overall. I think that is the big message. And then I just wanted to end with this realization that food carbon footprints are one element of what a sustainable food system is. We also need to be considering water use, biodiversity, economic development, equity issues, animal welfare, food security, public health. It's not just about carbon. So even though the carbon footprint helps us to get a window on what's happening with our environment and encourages folks to take a look at this more seriously, we really need to have a fuller vision of what we mean by a sustainable food system. So I'll end with those happy faces.
Thank you very much, Gail. Now, we've been going from the big picture to an approach using analysis that Gail has just shared with us. Now we're going to come down to a practical local application approach with our final presenter, Sabella Krause. Sabella is president of SAGE, the Sustainable Agriculture Education Group. It's a nonprofit located in Berkeley, California. They're spending a lot of their energy on development of agricultural parks, which Sabella will explain in her presentation. And she also directs the Agriculture in Metropolitan Regions program at UC Berkeley. Sabella?